Those things are strictly the weakness of my humanity, but something over which I expect to gain a victory.
The weakness of your humanity. He thought that over for a moment. That same little weakness that has always made you so intriguing, because it could make you so very dangerous.
You are implying, then, that I could betray you?
He approached her and rested his hands on her shoulders. Susan imagined how his hands would not have to move far to clamp around her neck. It is possible, he said, that someone is trying to betray me. Even now, I can read it in the atmosphere.
He looked at her very closely, his eyes burrowing into hers.
I might even be reading it in your very own eyes.
She turned her head away and said, I would not betray you.
He leaned closer and said very coolly, Nor would anyone else, if they knew what would be in store for them. It would be a very serious business indeed.
She felt his hands tighten their grip. A messenger streaked across the sky and then darted, zigzagged, and weaved through the woods above Ashton, looking for Tal. Captain! He called, but Tal was not there among the others. Where is the captain?
Mota answered, Carrying out another prayer gathering at Hank Bush's home. Be careful not to attract attention.
The messenger soared down the hillside and floated quietly into the maze of streets and alleys below. At Hank's house, Tal remained carefully hidden within the walls while some of his warriors carried out his orders, bringing in people ready to pray. Hank and Andy Forsythe had called a special prayer meeting, but they hadn't expected so many people to show up. More and more cars kept arriving, and more people kept filing through the door. The Colemans, Ron Forsythe and Cynthia, newly saved Bobby Corsi, his parents, Dan and Jean, the Joneses, the Coopers, the Smiths, the Bartons, some college students and their friends. Hank brought out whatever extra chairs he had. People began to find places on the floor. The room was getting stuffy. The windows were opened. Tal looked out the front and saw an old station wagon pull up. He smiled broadly. This was one arrival Hank would be glad to see. When the doorbell rang, several people hollered, Come in! But whoever it was didn't come in. Hank stepped over several people to get to the door and opened it. There stood Lou Stanley, together with his wife, Margie. They were holding hands. Lou smiled timidly and asked, Hi, Hank, is this where you're holding the prayer meeting? Hank believed again in miracles. Here was the man who had been removed from the church for adultery, now standing before him, reunited with his wife and wanting to pray with all the others.
Wow, said Hank, it sure is. Come on in.
Lou and Margie entered the packed living room where they were greeted with love and acceptance. Just then there was another knock on the door. Hank was still standing there, so he opened the door and saw an older man and his wife standing outside. He had never seen either one of them before. But Cecil Cooper knew who they were. He called to them from where he was sitting.
Well, praise the Lord! I don't believe it! James and Diane Farrell!
Hank looked at Cecil and then at the couple standing there, and his mouth dropped open.
Reverend Farrell?
Reverend James Farrell, former pastor of Ashton Community Church, extended his hand.
Pastor Henry Bush?
Hank nodded, taking his hand.
We got word there was a prayer meeting here tonight.
Hank invited them in with outstretched arms. Meanwhile, the messenger arrived and found Tal.
Captain, Gilo sends word that Susan's time is very short. She is very near discovery. You must come now.
Tal took a quick survey of the prayer cover he had gathered. It had to be enough for tonight's plan to work. Hank was starting the meeting.
The Lord has impressed on all of us that we need to pray tonight for Ashton. Now we've learned some things this afternoon, and we were sure right about Satan having a grip on this town. We need to pray that God will bind the demons that are trying to take over, and we need to pray for victory for the people of God and for the angels of God.
Good, good, Tal thought. It might be enough. But if what the messenger said was truly the situation at the strongman's lair,
They would have to proceed with the plan, whether the prayer cover was sufficient or not. The demonic cloud over the valley continued to thicken and swirl, and from their vantage point, Gilo and his warriors could see the glimmer of millions of pairs of yellow eyes. Gilo could not relax at all, but continually watched over the mountaintops for the one streak of light that would mark Tal's arrival. "Where is Tal?" he muttered. "Where is he? They know. They know." At this very moment, Kasif's entire staff, the implementing force behind Omni Corporation, was gathered in the dining hall for a makeshift banquet and final get-together before the big move for which they had all prepared. It was an informal buffet affair. Everything was casual and the mood was light. Kasif himself, usually aloof from his inferiors, mingled freely with them now, and hands often reached out to him as if imploring a special blessing. Susan remained steadfastly by his side, dressed again in her customary black suit, and hands also reached out to her for a special touch, a special glance, or a look of blessing. These she freely bestowed on the grateful followers. As the meal got under way, Kasif and Susan took their places at the head table. She tried to act normal and enjoy her food, but her master still maintained that smile, that strange, cutting, wicked smile, and it unnerved her. She had to wonder how much he really knew. Toward the end of the dinner, Kasif stood, and as if on signal, everyone in the room immediately became silent. "As we have done in other regions and other parts of our rapidly uniting world, so we shall do here," Kasif said, and the whole room applauded. "As a decisive and powerful tool of the Universal Consciousness Society, Omni Corporation is about to establish still another foothold for the coming New World Order and the rule of the New Age Christ. I have received word from our advanced people in Ashton that the purchase of our new facility can be finalized on Sunday, and I will personally go before you to close the deal. After that, the town will be ours."
The room broke into applause and cheers. But then, with a rather abrupt change of mood, Kasif let a scowl come upon his face, to which all those present responded with an equal sobriety.
"Of course, all through this massive effort, we have often been reminded of how serious this business really is in which we are involved, to which we have vowed our lives and our allegiances. We have often pondered how dire the results would be to everything we have worked toward if any one of us should ever turn toward the wrong and answer the persistent call of greed, temporality, or even," he looked at Susan, "human weakness."
Suddenly the room was dead quiet. Everyone's gaze was upon Kasif as his eye scanned slowly across the whole group. Susan could feel a terror starting to form deep down inside, a terror she had always tried to push down, avoid, control. She could feel the one thing she feared most of all slowly stalking up on her. Kasif continued,
"Only a few of you are aware that in the course of transferring the files from the head office, we discovered that several of our most sensitive folders were missing. Apparently, someone with high privilege and inside access thought those files would be of value, some other way."
The people began to gasp and murmur.
"Oh, don't be alarmed. I have a happy ending to this story. The missing files have been found."
They were all relieved and chuckled amongst themselves. This, they seemed to think, was another one of Kasif's little teasers. Kasif signaled to some security men toward the back of the room, and one of them picked up. What was it? Susan rose from her chair just a little to see. A cardboard box.
No. The cardboard box? The one she had hidden behind the linens?
He was bringing it toward the front, toward the head table. She remained where she was, but she thought she would faint. Her whole body trembled with fear. The blood drained from her face. Her insides were riddled with horrible pain. She had been discovered. There was no way out. It was a nightmare. The security guard lifted the heavy box under the table, and Kasif flung it open.
Yes, there were all the materials she had so painstakingly sorted out and hidden. He lifted them out and held them up for all to see. The whole crowd gasped in astonishment. Kasif threw the materials back into the box and let the guard carry it away.
"This box," he announced, "was found hidden in the maidservant's linen closet."
All were stunned. Some remained frozen with shock. Some shook their heads. Susan Jacobson prayed. She prayed furiously. The messenger arrived back in the valley, and Gila was voracious for news.
"Yes, speak up."
"He is gathering the prayer cover for operation tonight. He should be here at any moment."
"Any moment may be too late."
Gila looked toward the buildings below.
"Any moment, and Susan might be dead."
Tal watched while the gathered people prayed intently as the Holy Spirit led them and empowered them. They were praying specifically for the confounding of the demonic hosts. It just might be enough. He slipped out of the house, shrouded by the darkness. He would pass quickly through the town and then fly to the strong man's lair, hopefully in time to save Susan's life. But no sooner had he stepped into the narrow and rutted alley behind the house than he felt a sharp pain in his leg. His sword flashed into view in an instant, and in one quick movement he beheaded a small spirit that had been clinging to him. It dissolved in a puff of blood-red smoke. Another spirit clamped onto his back. He swept it away. Another on his back, another on his leg, two more slashing and nipping at his head.
"It is Tal," he heard them squeak and chatter. "It is Captain Tal."
Much more of this noise, and they would bring Rhaefar. Tal knew he would have to vanquish them all or risk exposure. The demons around his head went quickly enough. He swept his sword up and across his back and dismembered the one clinging there. But they seemed to multiply. Some of them were quite sizable, and all were greedy for the reward Rhaefar would give for whoever revealed Tal's whereabouts. A large laughing spirit flew in close for a look at Tal and then shot straight into the sky. Tal followed after him in an explosion of light and power and grabbed his ankles. The spirit screamed and began to claw at him. Tal dropped back to earth like a stone, dragging the spirit down with him, the spirit's wings flapping and fluttering like a torn umbrella. Once under the cover of trees and houses, Tal's sword sent the spirit into the abyss. But more demons were coming upon him from all directions. The word was spreading. Two powerful and muscular guards, the same two men who had once been her tuxedoed escorts, dragged and carried Susan between them, hardly letting her use her own feet to carry herself, across the grounds, up onto the porch of the big stone house, inside, up the ornate staircase, and down the upstairs hall to her room. Kasif followed, cool, collected, perfectly ruthless. The guards threw Susan down in a chair and held her there with their full weight, preventing her escape. Kasif took a long, icy look at her.
"Susan," he said, "my dear Susan, I am not really shocked at this. Such problems have happened before, with many others, many times, and every time we've had to deal with it. As you well know, such problems never remain. Never."
He moved in close, so close his words seemed to slap her like little whips.
"I never trusted you, Susan. I told you that. So I've kept my eye on you. I've had the others keep their eye on you, and I see now that you have rekindled your friendship with my rival, Mr. Weed." He laughed at that. "I have eyes and ears everywhere, dear Susan. Since the moment your Mr. Weed went to the Ashton Clarion, we have made his business, every aspect of it, our business. Where he goes, whom he knows, whomever he calls, and whatever he says. And as for the hurried and careless call you made to him today..." He laughed loudly. "Oh, Susan, did you really think we wouldn't monitor every phone call going out of here? We knew you would make your move sooner or later. All we had to do was wait and be ready. An undertaking such as ours is naturally going to have enemies. We understand that."
He leaned over her, his eyes cold and cunning.
"But we most certainly do not tolerate it. No, Susan, we deal with it harshly and abruptly. I had thought that one little harassment would silence Weed, but now I find that thanks to you he knows far too much. Therefore, it will be best if you and your Mr. Weed are taken care of."
All she could do was tremble. She could think of nothing to say. She knew it would be useless to beg for mercy.
"You have never been to one of our blood rituals, have you?"
Kaseth began to explain it to her as if giving a short lecture.
"The ancient worshippers of Isis or Molech or Ashtoreth were not too far afield in their practices. They understood, at least, that the offering of a human life to their so-called gods seemed to bring the gods' favor upon them. What they performed in ignorance, we now continue with enlightenment. The life force that intertwines itself through us and our universe is cyclical, never-ending, self-perpetuating. The birth of the new cannot occur without the death of the old. The birth of good is created by the death of evil. This is karma, dear Susan. Your karma."
In other words, he was going to kill her. A warrior asked Gilo, "What is that? What are they doing?" They both listened. The cloud, still stirring and swirling slowly about the valley floor, was trickling and babbling now with a strange sound, an indefinable noise that gradually rose in volume and pitch. At first it sounded like the rush of faraway waves, then it grew into the roar of a numberless mob. From this it crescendoed into an eerie wailing of millions of sirens. Gilo slowly brought his sword out, and the metal of the blade rang.
"What are you doing?" asked the warrior.
"Prepare," Gilo ordered, and the order was spread among the group. Ring, ring, ring went their blades as each warrior took his sword in his hand. "They're laughing," said Gilo. "There's nothing we can do but go in." The warrior was willing, and yet the thought was unthinkable.
"Go in? Go into that?"
The demons were strong, brutal, savage. And now they were laughing, with the smell of approaching death like sweet perfume in their nostrils. Triskall and Creone came swooping into the valley, swords blazing and sweeping in lethal arcs of light as demons disintegrated on all sides. Other warriors shot into the sky like flares from a cannon, plucking fleeing demons out of the air, silencing them. Tal was in a real bind, wishing he could release his fighting powerful force, and yet needing to remain subdued lest he draw attention to himself. Thus he could not vanquish the spirits now clustering on him like angry bees in one violent attack, but rather had to pluck them off one by one, hacking and chopping with his sword. Mota entered the scuffle and came in close to Tal, swinging his sword and plucking demons off his captain like bats off a cave wall.
"There! There now! And another!"
Then came one infinitesimal moment when Tal was clean of demons. Mota quickly slipped into his place while Tal vanished into the ground. The spirits were enraged by the fighting and at first continued to flock and circle about the area. But then they realized that Tal had somehow slipped away and they were only placing themselves in the hands of heavenly warriors to be destroyed for no reason. Their numbers quickly dwindled, their cries ebbed away, and soon they were gone. Several miles outside of Ashton, Tal shot out of the ground like a bullet from a rifle streaking across the sky, a trail of light following him like the tail of a comet, his sword held straight out in front of him. Farms, fields, forests, and highways became a blur beneath him. The clouds became rushing mountains passing by on either side. He could feel his strength building with the prayers of the saints. His sword began to burn with power, glowing brilliantly. He almost felt it was pulling him through the sky, faster and faster, the wind screaming, the distance shrinking, his wings an invisible roar. He flew for the strong man's lair. A very strange-looking black-robed and beaded long-haired little guru from some dark and pagan land stepped into Susan's room at Kasif's bidding. He bowed in obedience to his lord and master, Kasif.
"Prepare the altar," said Kasif. "There will be a special offering for the success of our endeavor."
The little pagan priest left quickly. Kasif returned his attention to Susan. He took one look at her and then gave her the back of his hand.
"Stop that!" he shouted. "Stop that praying!"
The force of the blow nearly knocked her out of the chair.
but one guard held her firmly. Her head sank, and she began to sob in very short, shallow gasps of terror. Kasif, like a conqueror, stood above her and boasted over her limp and trembling form.
"You have no god to call upon. With the nearness of your death you crumble. You fall back upon old myths and religious nonsense."
Then he said, almost kindly,
"What you don't realize is that I'm actually doing you a favor. Perhaps in your next life your understanding will be deeper, your frailties will have fallen away, your sacrificial gift to us now will build wonderful karma for you in the lives to come. You'll see."
Then he spoke to the guards.
"Bind her."
They grabbed her wrists and held them behind her. She heard a click and felt the cold steel of the manacles. She heard herself screaming. Kasif went to his office, now a bare room except for a few remaining shipping crates and travel cases. He went directly to a small case covered with fine old leather and tucked it under his arm. Then he went down the big staircase to the lower floor, through an imposing plank door and down another stairway into the deep basement below the house. He turned one corner, passed through another door, and entered a dark, candlelit room of stone. The strange little priest was already there, lighting candles and moaning some strange, unintelligible words over and over. Some of Kasif's closest confidants were present, waiting quietly. Kasif handed the little case to the priest, who laid it beside a large, rough-hewn bench at one end of the room. The little priest opened the case and began to set out knives, Kasif's knives, ornate, jeweled, delicately wrought, razor-sharp. Tal could see the mountains ahead. He would have to stay in close to the rocky sides. He must not be seen. Gilo and his warriors remained in the darkness, unglorified, stalking step by step downward toward the complex, concealing themselves behind rocks and old snags. Just above them now, boiling and towering like a thunderhead, the cloud of leering, laughing spirits continued to swirl. Gilo was sensing some prayer cover. Surely the demons would have noticed them by now, but their eyes were strangely unseeing. Down below, parked very near the main administration building, was a large van. Gilo found a spot from which he could see the van clearly, then had his warriors fan out, keeping one warrior close by for special instructions. "Do you see the upper window in the big stone house?" Gilo asked him.
"Yes."
"She is there. On my signal, go alone and get her out." Chapter 29 In the strange dark room below the house, Alexander M. Kasif and his little entourage remained transfixed in deep meditation. Before them, just behind the rough wooden bench, stood the strong man, flanked by his close guards and assistants. His sagging face was spread now with a hideous, drooling grin that bared his fangs as he chuckled with demonic delight.
"One by one, the obstacles are falling," he said. "Yes, yes, your offering will bring you good fortune, and it will please me."
The big yellow eyes narrowed with the command.
"Bring her."
Upstairs, sitting helplessly between the two guards, her feet and hands bound with manacles, Susan Jacobson waited and prayed. With all that was within her, she cried out to the one true God, the God whom she did not know but must be there, had to hear her, and was the only one who could help her now. Tal reached the mountains and soared up their steep face, climbing, climbing, easing back his speed. He continued to slow as he neared the top, and then, just as he crested the summit, he stopped all motion and all sound and let himself glide down the other side silently, invisibly. He noticed with concern that the cloud had grown even more since he'd been away. He could only hope the prayer cover would at least be sufficient to blind these foul creatures. Gilo had been watching for the captain, and his sharp eyes saw Tal descending like a silent hawk toward them. "Get ready," Gilo told the warrior at his side. The warrior was poised, his eyes on that upstairs window. Tal dropped down so low he was almost skidding along the ground. He finally came to rest right beside Gilo. "We have the cover," he said. "Go,"
Gilo commanded the warrior, and the warrior half flew, half ran toward the big stone house. The little priest, his eyes darting about with anticipation, made his way up the big staircase, humming and muttering a mantra to himself. Kasif and his people waited downstairs in a hushed silence, Kasif standing right next to the knives. Susan Jacobson tried to work the shackles loose, but they were clamped on tightly enough to cut into her even if she didn't struggle. The guards only laughed at her.
"Dear God," she prayed, "if you are truly the ruler of this universe, please have mercy on one who dared to stand for your sake against a terrible evil."
And then, as if she were no longer in that room, as if she were slowly waking up from a nightmare, the agonizing, heart-twisting fear began to ebb from her mind like a fading thought, like the slow, steady calming of a storm. Her heart was at rest. The room seemed strangely quiet. All she could do was look around with very curious eyes. What had happened? Had she died already? Was she asleep or dreaming? But she had felt this way before. The memory of that one night in New York came back to her. She thought of that strange, buoyed-up feeling she had had, even as she clambered desperately through that window. There was someone in the room. She could sense it.
"Are you here to help me?"
she asked in her heart, and the faintest little spark of hope came to life again somewhere deep inside her. Clink! Her feet were suddenly released, and could swing unbound from the chair. The shackles lay on the floor, opened. She felt something break loose from around her wrists, and she pulled her arms free. The manacles clinked to the floor, just like the shackles that had bound her feet. She looked at the two guards, but they were just standing there looking at her, still smirking, then looking elsewhere as if nothing had happened. Then she heard a click, and looked just in time to see the window latch twist loose and the big bedroom window swing open all by itself. The cool night air began to waft into the room. Whether this was illusion or reality, she accepted it. She jumped up from the chair. The guards did nothing. She ran for that open window. Then she remembered. Still keeping a wary and unbelieving eye on those guards, she hurried to the bed, reached under it, and pulled out the suitcase that Kasif and his people had not found, even in such an obvious hiding place. It felt strangely light for all the paper she had loaded in it, but nothing at this moment made much sense anyway, so she simply accepted how easy it was to carry the suitcase to the window and set it on the rooftop outside. She looked behind her. The guards were smiling confidently at an empty chair. Feeling as if someone was lifting her, she climbed through the window and onto the roof. A thick vine grew up one side of the house. It would make a perfect escape ladder. Outside the administration building, some security people were talking in hushed tones about the fall of the maidservant and her imminent fate, when suddenly they heard footsteps running across the parking area.
"Hey, look there!"
someone shouted. The security men looked just in time to see a woman dressed in black scurrying from one of the trucks.
"Hey, what are you doing?"
"It's the maidservant."
They ran after her, but she had already reached a big moving van and climbed inside. The starter growled, the engine came to life, and with a lurch and a whine, the van started rolling away. Gilo leaped from his hiding place and bellowed, "Yah-ha!" as his little troop of 23 popped into the air like fireworks and trailed after the van.
"Cover yourselves, warriors!"
The little priest reached Susan's bedroom, and his bony hand opened the door.
"We are ready,"
he declared, and suddenly realized that he was talking to a pair of very dedicated guards, making very sure an empty chair would not get away. The little pagan had a first-class fit. The guards had no explanation. The van sluggishly headed up the winding and precarious road that led out of the valley and over the mountains. Four angels swooped down behind it and started pushing it up the grade, helping it to top 60. They were making good time, but looking back they could see an oncoming legion of demons in hot pursuit, the glimmer of their fangs and the red flicker of their blades filling the night sky. From high above, Gilo watched the cloud. It remained where it was, covering the strong man. Only a small contingent of demonic warriors had been sent after the runaway van. Roaring up the mountain road in pursuit, four of Kasif's armed security men gave chase in a high-powered jeep. Even so, they had a surprising amount of trouble catching up.
"I thought that thing had a full load," said one. "It does," said the other. "I loaded it myself." "How many horses does that thing have?"
By now, Kasif had gotten word of Susan's escape. He ordered 8 more armed men and 2 more vehicles to join the chase. They leaped into another jeep and a V8-powered sports car and squealed out of the parking lot. Demons and angels converged on the van, still chugging up the steep grade at more than 60 miles an hour, its tires growling and often skidding sideways across the winding, reeling gravel road. The 4 angels kept pushing it from behind while the other 19 did their best to encircle it and ward off demonic attack. Demons dove down from above, their red swords gleaming, and engaged the heavenly warriors in fierce dogfights, the blades singing, droning, and clashing metallically with bursts of sparks. The van came to the summit and picked up more speed. The pursuing vehicles topped the summit only seconds behind it. As the van accelerated more and more, the bumps and curves in the roadway became one death-dealing jolt or one frame-bending wrench after another, and the van rocked, dancing on 2 and 3 wheels as it careened down the steep grade. The road went straight, then turned abruptly, then twisted back the other direction, then took a dip. The van wrestled the road as the rocks and guardrails blurred by. With each sharp curve, it groaned and leaned heavily toward the outside, the big frame bottoming out the springs, the tires screeching in protest. A very sharp left turn. The van's heavy back end fishtailed into the guardrail with a loud grinding and a fiery shower of sparks. Down the road, another dip, the springs bottoming out, the frame crunching down on the axles, groaning and creaking. The jeeps and sports cars followed behind, doing much better at negotiating the treacherous curves, but getting the ride of their lives all the same. 2 men in the lead jeep had high-powered rifles ready, but it was impossible to get any clear shot. They fired a few rounds anyway, if only to scare the maidservant. The van was headed right for a hairpin turn, with yellow signs everywhere screaming at it to slow down and be cautious. The 4 angels who had been behind the van pushing were now pressed up against its sides, trying to keep it on the road. Gylo himself swooped down, his sword flashing, hacking his way through demon interceptors until he could work his way to the van. It was only a fraction of a second from the guardrail and the sheer drop beyond it when Gylo slammed forcefully into its side, jolting the front wheels to the left with a sharp jerk. The van made the turn and rolled on. The pursuers and the other vehicles had to slow down or go right through the guardrail. But the heavenly warriors trying to encircle the van were being steadily cut away. Gylo looked just in time to see one huge spirit pounce with bared talons on top of a warrior like a hawk on a sparrow, knocking the angel senseless, making it flutter down into the deep canyon below. Another dogfight high above and to the left ended in a cry of pain from another warrior who went into a crazy spin. One wing shredded and disappeared inside the wall of a mountain. The ringing clashes of blades echoed all around. There went a demon disappearing in a trail of red smoke. Another angel fell toward the canyon floor, still holding his sword, but listless and stunned, his demon pursuer right behind him. The hideous warriors of hell finally began to break through and reach the van. One reached the warrior right behind Gylo and knocked him away. Gylo didn't have time to think another thought before his own sword went up to fend off the incredibly powerful blow of a spirit at least equal to himself. Gylo returned the blow, their swords locked for a moment, arm against arm, and then Gylo made good use of his foot to cave in the demon's face and send it tumbling out over the canyon. The van began to swerve wildly, the tires tiptoeing on the very edge of the chasm. Gylo pushed with all his might to get it back on course. The van lurched again, and he realized a band of demons must be on the other side pushing against him. He looked around for help and saw more fangs and yellow eyes than friends. A huge blade swept downward over his shoulder, and he parried it off. Another one thrust toward his midsection, and he struck that away. The van veered toward the cliff. He tried to push back, parry a blow, look for help, strike another demon, kick a face, push the van, cut a flank, parry a blow, guide the van. A blow. He didn't see it coming and had no idea who had struck it, but it stunned him. He lost his grip on the van, saw the canyon floor spinning far below, saw the earth, the sky, the earth, the sky. He was falling. He spread his wings and floated downward like a torn and fallen leaf. From high above, he heard a blood-curdling howl. He looked up. This must be the one who had struck him, a very large, bulb-eyed nightmare with reptilian skin and serrated wings. "Come, come," Gylo muttered, waiting for the thing to pounce. It dove straight at him, its jaws gaping, its fangs glimmering, a wide flat blade with keen edge flashing. Gyla waited. The thing raised its sword high and brought it down with a whoosh. Gyla was suddenly 3 feet away from where he had been, and the blade continued on its way without their having met, the demon somersaulting wildly after it. Gyla made a blinding sweep with his own sword and de-winged the demon, then finished it. The boiling trail of red smoke cleared away from Gyla's eyes just in time for him to see the van crash through a guardrail and sail out over the precipice. The fall was so far, so very long and extended that the van seemed to float for an eternity before folding and crushing on the rocks below, twisting, turning, bouncing like a pop can as chairs, desks, and cabinets tumbled out the back and papers upon papers fluttered through the air like snowflakes. About 30 demons hovered high above or roosted on the remaining guardrail to watch their work come to completion. After turning and rolling over and over, the van, no longer recognizable as anything, finally came to rest in a heap of scrap and glass at the base of the mountain. The 3 pursuing vehicles pulled to a stop, and the 12 security men got out to take a satisfied look. Gyla rested on a rocky crag, setting his sword down and looking skyward. High above, he could make out minute streaks of light heading in several different directions, each one followed by 2 or 3 streaks of red-accented black. His warriors, what was left of them, were scattering in all directions. Gyla thought it best to remain where he was until the skies cleared. He, Tal, and their warriors would all regroup in Ashton soon enough. Rhaefar still sat in his big dead tree, watching over the town of Ashton as a master at chess would sit and look over a game board. He enjoyed watching the many pieces and pawns make their moves against each other. When a demon messenger brought the welcome news from the strong man's lair that the maidservant, that traitorous wench, had come to a miserable end, and the heavenly host had been routed, Rhaefar gloated and laughed. He had taken his opponent's queen.
"And so shall it be for the rest," Rhaefar said with diabolical glee. "The strong man entrusted the preparation of the town to me. When he comes, he will find it unoccupied, swept, and put in order."
He called some of his warriors.
"It's time to clean house. While the heavenly hosts are weak and cannot stand against us, we should take care of the final obstacles. I would like Hogan and Bush put away like vanquished kings. Make use of the woman Carmen, and see to it that they are bound and helpless, a byword and a mockery. As for Kevin Weed,"
the demon warlord's eyes narrowed with disdain,
"he could never be a worthy prize for such as myself. See that he is killed any way you wish. Then bring me word."
The warriors departed to carry out his orders. Rhaefar heaved a deep, half-mocking sigh.
"Oh, dear captain of the host, perhaps I will see my battle won with no more than a raised finger, a casual order, the poison of my subtlety. Your sky-rending trump of battle will be displaced by a pitiful whimper, and my victory will be won without my ever having seen your face or your sword."
He looked over the town and broke into his fiendish grin, clicking his thumb talon across his other 4.
"But do be sure of this. We shall meet, Tal. Do not think to hide behind your praying saints, for we can both see they have failed you. You and I shall meet."
Bernice knew it would be difficult, even dangerous, to drive without her glasses, but Marshall never answered his phone, so the meeting with Kevin Weed was entirely up to her and certainly worth the risk. So far, as she drove up Highway 27, the daylight was sufficient to make out the center line and the oncoming blobs, so she pressed on toward the big green bridge north of Baker. Kevin Weed also had that bridge in mind as he sat at the bar in the Evergreen Tavern with his hands around a beer and his eyes on the big lucky lager clock. Somehow he felt safer here than at home by himself. He had buddies around, lots of noise, the ball game on television, the shuffleboard game going on behind him, His hands still shook, though, every time he let go of his beer mug, so most of the time he hung on to it and tried to act normal. The front door kept scraping the linoleum as more people came in. The place was warming up, which was just fine. The more the merrier. Several loggers had beers to buy and stories to tell. There were bets going around on the shuffleboard game. Tonight, a long-standing rivalry would be settled once and for all. Kevin took time to smile and greet his friends and exchange a little jaw time. That helped him loosen up. Two loggers came in. They were new, he figured. He'd never seen them before. But they fit right in with the rest of the bunch and were quick to get everyone caught up on where they were working and for how long and how the weather had been good, bad, or indifferent. They even came up and sat with him at the bar. "Hey," said one, extending his hand. "Mark Hansen."
"Kevin Weed," he said, shaking Mark's hand.
Mark introduced Kevin to the other guy, Steve Drake. They hit it off fine, talking logging, baseball, deer hunts, and booze, and Kevin's hands quit shaking. He even finished his beer.
"Want another beer?"
Mark asked.
"Yeah, sure, thanks."
Dan brought the beers, and the conversation kept rattling on. A loud cheer went up from the shuffleboard championship for all time, and the three of them spun around in their seats to see the winner shaking hands with the loser. Mark was quick. When no one was looking, he emptied a small vial into Kevin's beer. The shuffleboard crowd began to congregate at the bar. Kevin checked the clock. It was time to go, anyway. In all the hubbub and chatter, he managed to say so long to his two new acquaintances, down his beer, and head for the door. Mark and Steve gave him a friendly wave as he went. Kevin climbed in his old pickup and drove off. He figured he would even get to the bridge a little early. Just thinking about it made him start shaking again. Mark and Steve wasted no time. Kevin had no sooner pulled out onto the highway than they were in their own pickup truck, following some distance behind. Steve checked his watch.
"Won't be long now," he said.
"So, where do we dump him?" asked Mark.
"What's wrong with the river? He's headed there anyway."
It must have been that last beer, Kevin was thinking to himself. He must have chugged it down too fast or something. His stomach was letting him know about it. On top of that, he had to go to the bathroom. On top of that, he was really getting sleepy. He spent a few miles debating what to do, but finally he figured he had better pull over before he just plain keeled over. A garishly painted, sagging, low, overhead hamburger joint was just ahead. He pulled off the highway and managed to bring the truck to a safe stop beside the building. He didn't notice the pickup truck that pulled off the highway and then waited some 100 yards behind him.
"Terrific," said Mark angrily. "So what's he going to do, keel over right in front of that hamburger place? I thought that stuff was supposed to hit hard and fast."
Steve only shook his head.
"Maybe he just has to go to the bathroom. We'll have to wait and see."
It looked like Steve was right. Kevin stumbled and staggered his way into the men's restroom behind the building. For a minute or so, they stared at the restroom door. Steve looked at his watch again. Time was getting short.
"If he comes out and gets back on the road, the stuff should hit him before he reaches the bridge."
"If he even comes out," Mark muttered. "What if we have to drag him out of there?"
No, here he came, out the restroom door, looking a little better. As the two men watched, Kevin climbed back into his truck and pulled back out onto the highway. They followed him, waiting for something to happen. It did. The truck began to swerve, first to the left, then back to the right.
"There he goes," said Steve.
Up ahead was the Judd River Bridge, a steel span over a very deep chasm carved out by the Judd River. The little truck kept speeding along crazily, veering clear over into the left lane, then back again into the right lane, and then over onto the shoulder.
"He's fighting it, trying to stay awake," Steve observed.
"It's probably watered down with too much beer."
The truck went over onto the shoulder, and the tires began to wobble and dig into the soft gravel. The rear wheel spun and threw rocks, and the truck fishtailed along for several feet, heading for the bridge. But by now the driver had no control and seemed to have slipped into sleep with his foot on the gas pedal. The truck roared and accelerated, then shot across the road, roared across the wide turnoff just before the bridge, leaped upon a clump of alder saplings, and finally soared off the rocky precipice and into the river canyon below. Mark and Steve pulled to a stop on the bridge just in time to look over the side and see the truck sinking wheels up into the river.
"Score one more for Kazev," said Steve. Another driver in an oncoming car screeched to a halt and jumped out of his auto. Soon another vehicle pulled up. The bridge was starting to get clogged with excited people. Mark and Steve eased away, making their way off the bridge.
"We'll call the fire department,"
Mark shouted out his window, and away they went, never to be seen or heard from again.
Chapter 30 Kate, Sandy, the Network, Bernice, Langstrat, the Network, Omni, Kasif, Kate, Sandy, Bernice. Marshall's thoughts went around and around as he stood at the sliding glass door just off the kitchen and watched daylight ebb slowly away from the backyard, from the delicate orange wash of sunset to the sad, ever-deepening gray of nightfall. Maybe it was the longest time he had ever spent in just one spot in his whole life. But maybe this right here and now was the end of the life he had always known. Sure, he had gone through several little attempts at denial, at trying to prove to himself that these cosmic characters, these far-out conspirators, were nothing but wind. But he kept coming back to the cold, hard facts. Harmel was right. Marshall was now out on his ear like everybody else. Believe it, Hogan. Hey, it's happened, whether you believe it or not. He was out, just like Harmel, just like Strawn, just like Edie, just like Jefferson, Gregory, the Carlucci's, Waller, James, Jacobson. Marshall rubbed his hand over his head and stopped the train of names and facts coursing through his brain. Such thoughts were beginning to hurt. Each one of them seemed to punch him in the stomach as it passed through his brain. But how did they do it? How could they be so powerful that they actually destroyed lives on a personal level? Was it only coincidence? Marshall couldn't settle that question. He was too close to it, having lost his own family and having the network to blame, but also himself. It would be so easy to blame the conspiracy for tampering with his family and turning his wife and daughter against him, and undoubtedly they had tried it. But where could he draw the line between their responsibility and his? All he knew was that his family had fallen apart, and now he was out, just like all the others. Wait, there was a noise at the front door. Could it be Kate? He stepped to the kitchen door and looked toward the front room. Whoever it was ducked around a corner very hurriedly as soon as he showed his face. "Sandy?" he called. For a moment there was no answer, but then he heard Sandy reply in a very strange, cold tone of voice.
"Yes, Daddy, it's me."
He almost broke into a run, but he forced himself to take it easy and walk lightly to her bedroom. He looked in and saw her going through her closet, moving rather hurriedly and nervously, and she showed a definite discomfort at his watching her.
"Where's Mom?"
she asked. "Well," he said, trying to come up with an answer, "she's gone to her mother's for a while."
"She's left you, in other words,"
she replied quite directly. Marshall was direct, too. Yeah, that's right." He watched her for a while. She was grabbing clothing and belongings and throwing them into a suitcase and some shopping bags. "Looks like you're leaving, too."
"That's right," she said without slowing down or even looking up. "I felt it coming. I knew what Mom was thinking, and I think she was right. You get along so well all by yourself. We may as well let you have it that way for keeps."
"Where will you go?" Sandy looked up at him for the first time, and Marshall was chilled and even sickened by the look in her eyes, a strange, glassy, maniacal expression he had never seen before.
"I'll never tell you," she said, and Marshall couldn't believe the way she said it.
It was not Sandy at all. "Sandy," he said gently, pleadingly, "can we talk? I won't put any pressure or demands on you. Could we just talk?" Those very strange eyes glared at him again, and this person who used to be his loving daughter responded with,
"I'll see you in hell."
Marshall immediately sensed those all too familiar sensations of fear and doom. Something had come into his house.
Hank answered the door and immediately felt a certain check in his spirit. Carmen stood there. She was dressed neatly and conservatively this time, and her demeanor was much more down to earth. Yet Hank had his qualms. "Well, hi," he said. She smiled disarmingly and said, "Hello, Pastor Bush." He stepped aside and motioned for her to come in. She stepped inside the door in time to see Mary coming from the kitchen. "Hello, Mary," she said. "Hello," said Mary. She took an extra step and gave Carmen a loving embrace. "Are you all right?"
"Much better, thank you."
She looked at Hank, and her eyes were full of repentance.
"Pastor, I really owe you an apology for the way I acted before. It must have been very alarming for you both."
Hank hemmed and hawed a little and finally said, "Well, we certainly were concerned for your welfare." Mary moved toward the living room and said,
"Won't you have a seat? Can I bring you anything?" "Thank you, no," said Carmen, sitting down on the sofa. "I won't be staying long."
Hank sat in a chair opposite the sofa and looked at Carmen, praying a mile a minute. Yes, she looked different, like she'd gotten a lot of loose ends finally tied together in her life. And yet, Hank had seen a lot in the last few days, and he had the distinct impression that he was seeing more of the same thing this very moment. There was something about her eyes. Sandy backed up a little and narrowed her eyes at Marshall like a wild bull about to charge.
"You get out of my way!"
Marshall remained in the bedroom door, blocking it with his body.
"I don't want a big fight, Sandy. I won't stand in your way forever. I just want you to think for a moment, okay? Can you just calm down and give me an audience just one last time, huh?"
She stood there rigidly, breathing heavily through her nose. Her lips shut tightly, her body crouched a little. It was simply unreal. Marshall tried to calm her down with his voice, as if approaching a wild horse.
"I'll let you go anywhere you want. It's your life. But we don't dare part without saying what needs to be said. I love you, you know."
She didn't respond to that.
"I really do love you. Do you believe that at all?"
You don't know the meaning of the word."
Yeah, I can understand that. I haven't done very well these past years. But listen, we can put it back together. Why let this thing go in the shape it's in when we could heal it?"
She looked him over again, observed how he was still standing in the doorway, and said,
"Daddy, all I want right now is to get out of here."
In a minute. Marshall tried to speak slowly, carefully, gently. "Sandy, I don't know if I can explain it to you very clearly, but remember what you said yourself about the town that one Saturday, how you thought, what was it, aliens were taking over the town? Do you remember that?"
She didn't answer, but she seemed to be listening.
"You don't know how right you were. How true that theory really was. There are people in this town, Sandy, right now that want to take the whole town over. And they also want to destroy anyone who gets in their way. Sandy, I'm someone who got in their way."
Sandy began to shake her head incredulously. She wasn't buying it.
"Listen to me, Sandy. Just listen. Now, I run the paper, see, and I know what they're up to, and they know that I know. So they're just doing what they can to destroy me, take away my house, the newspaper, undermine my family."
He looked at her in earnest, but had no idea if any of this was getting through.
"All that's happening to us, it's what they want. They want this family to fall apart."
"You're crazy," she finally said. "You're a maniac. Get out of the way."
"Sandy, listen to me. They've even been using you against me. Did you know those cops in town are trying to find anything they can to put me away? They're trying to pin a murder rap on me. And it even sounds like they're accusing me of abusing you. That's how terrible this whole thing is. You have to understand."
"But you did it," Sandy cried. "You know you did it."
Marshall was stunned. All he could do was stare at her. She had to be crazy.
What, Sandy?
She actually broke down and tears came to her eyes as she said,
You raped me. You raped me.
Carmen seemed to be having a very difficult time getting around to whatever she had come to tell them.
I just don't know how to begin. It's just so difficult.
Hank reassured her. Oh, you're among friends. Carmen looked at Mary sitting at the other end of the sofa and then at Hank still sitting opposite her.
Hank, I just can't live with it anymore.
Hank said, Then why don't you just give it over to Jesus? He's the healer, you know. He can take away your regrets and your sorrows, believe me. She looked at him and only shook her head incredulously.
Hank, I am not here to play games. It's time we were truthful and cleared the air once and for all. We're just not being fair to Mary.
Hank didn't know what she was talking about, so he just leaned forward and nodded, his way of telling her he was listening. She continued,
Well, I guess I'll just have to say it and get it out. I'm sorry, Hank.
She turned to Mary, her eyes filling with tears, and said,
Mary, for the last several months, ever since our first counseling appointment, Hank and I have been seeing each other on a regular basis.
Mary asked,
What do you mean by that?
Carmen turned to Hank and implored him,
Hank, don't you think you should be the one to tell her?
Tell her what? Hank asked. Carmen looked at Mary, took her hand, and said,
Mary, Hank and I have been having an affair.
Mary looked startled, but not very stunned. She did pull her hand away from Carmen's. Then she looked at Hank.
What do you think? She asked him.
Hank took another good look at Carmen and then nodded to Mary. Mary turned directly toward Carmen, and Hank got up out of his chair. They both looked intently at Carmen, and she began to look away from their eyes.
It's true, she insisted. Tell her, Hank. Please tell her.
Spirit, said Hank firmly, I command you in the name of Jesus to be silent and come out of her.
There were 15 of them packed into Carmen's body like crawling superimposed maggots, boiling, writhing, a tangle of hideous arms, legs, talons, and heads. They began to squirm. Carmen began to squirm. They moaned and cried out, and so did Carmen, her eyes turning glassy and staring blankly. Outside the room, Creone and Triskal watched from a distance. Triskal fumed.
Orders, orders, orders.
Creone reminded him. Tal knows what he's doing. Triskal pointed toward the living room and cried, Hank's playing with a bomb in there. You see those demons? They'll tear him apart.
We have to stay out of it, Creone said. We can protect Hank's and Mary's lives, but we cannot keep the demons from doing whatever they might do.
Creone was having trouble with it himself. Sandy got louder and louder. Marshall felt that at any moment he would lose control of her altogether.
You let me out of here, or you're going to be in big trouble, she nearly screamed.
Marshall could only stand there in total dismay and horror.
Sandy, it's me, Marshall Hogan, your father. Think, Sandy. You know I never touched you, I never molested you, I only loved you and cared for you. You're my daughter, my only daughter.
You did it to me,
she cried hysterically.
When, Sandy, he demanded, when did I ever touch you wrongly?
It was something my mind had blocked out for years, but Professor Langstrat brought it out.
Langstrat?
She put me under hypnosis, and I saw it like it was yesterday. You did it, and I hate you.
You never remembered it because it never happened. Think, Sandy.
I hate you. You did it to me.
Nathan and Armoth from outside the house could see the hideous, deceiving spirit clinging to Sandy's back, its talons deep in her skull. Alongside them was Tal. He had just given them their special orders.
Captain, said Armoth, we don't know what that thing might do.
Preserve their lives, said Tal, but Hogan must fall. As for Sandy, see to it that a special detachment follows her at a distance. They'll be able to move when the time is right.
Just then, with a very low, stealthy trajectory, Cigna floated in for a landing. "Captain," he reported, "Kevin Weed is dead. It worked." Tal gave Cigna a strange, knowing look and smile. "Excellent,"